going to do is I have taken some questions here and have put them together. And what we're going to do is we're going to let our speakers respond to them. And I'm going to ask our speakers, if you would please, to read the question, assuming you can read the writing, and then answer. And you may want to, Dr. Beisner, the first several questions I think are kind of related, so you may want to lump them together. And I will say this also, that that our speakers have the right of first refusal. Just because you write a question doesn't mean they're going to answer it, especially there are times when we get some frivolous questions, and sometimes frivolous questions can be answered. Sometimes they aren't necessarily frivolous, but sometimes we don't want to take things up, times up for some of the questions. So I give them the questions, but they have the right of first refusal. So if you've had the opportunity to look at some of these, is somebody ready to answer a question, and then we'll just pass it down. But I will ask our speakers if you'll read the question and then give an answer and then pass it on. Somebody ready to begin? I see people looking surreptitiously at one another.
I've got four here that all
yes.
Address the same thing but in very different ways. I'd like a little time to think it through.
All right. We'll give you time. Da 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 da.
All right, I can start.
Okay, there we go.
Unless Dr. Klosterma was sorry. No, go ahead.
I did expect that from a Dutch Pope person, yes. They always wait till the bitter end. For people who are interested in mission work, how could we contact you? Email address, phone number? No, you can't. I was just kidding about it. No, I'm not. I got two websites. One of them is called BulgarianReformation.org, and tomorrow I'm going to put both of them up on the screen for y'all to write them down. But I got two websites. One of them is where I develop my view of what we need to do today. It's called ChristendomRestored.com, and it's in the very beginning. I have just a few articles on it, but it's going to be developed into a bigger project of how we need to restore the Christian civilization. A big part of it is going to be missions as well. I'm going to go back to history and see how missionaries in the past have done that. I got a few articles in American Vision on that, on missionaries like St. Boniface and Isidore of Seville and so on, but it's going to be probably a book in the future. So, and the website that's specifically concerned with mission work is called BulgarianReformation.org, and I'm going to have them all tomorrow on the two sites on the screen for y'all to write them down. And of course, you can catch me in the I'm running fast, but if you can catch me in the lobby, I can give you my email and address and phone number and so on. But I will be really interested talking to you if you're interested about the mission field. And the reason is, let me put it this way: according to the International Board of Missions. And this is statistics I cannot verify. It's not easy to verify, but I think these guys are serious about it. In 2008, American Christianity, that means your parents, spend, let me first give you the numbers, or the missionaries, the number of missionaries around the world. We have about 55,000 American missionaries full-time around the world. It doesn't include their families. It only includes those that are missionaries. Okay? And we have another 50,000 part-time going around the world. And we pay for that mission endeavor the sum annually of $2.5 billion. Yes. The American church pays for missions $2.5 billion a year. And you, I'll get that reaction. Now you're thinking $2.5 billion, the whole homeschool market in the United States is $5 billion a year. Can we pay for 50,000 missionaries that much? But yes, that's how much money we pay for missions. In order to give you a better perspective on it, if you translate this into gold, okay, into gold, between AD 30 and AD 1900, the church paid for missions less than what we pay now a year. For 18, 19 centuries, all the expenses for missions were less than what we pay now, only the American church, a year. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing. We haven't changed any nations in the last 100 years. We don't see one nation that you can say between then and now it's a Christian nation now. We don't see nations like this. We need to change the way we do missions, but it's a bigger project. And yes, contact me, I'll be very happy. I can continue with the questions unless you want to offer me.
Okay. Here we go. I have four different questions here that all address the issue of GMO, genetic modification, genetically modified organisms, or genetic modification generally. And I want to see if I can take this first one sort of piecemeal, because it... Is this still working? Yeah, I guess it is. Because it... It wraps a lot of things together. The question is fairly long here. It starts off, I love your mission and many things you are doing. I'll just stop there. However, you know, you always know there's going to be a but, however, coming when somebody starts off that way. I wonder if you are accepting modern scientific assessments too uncritically. I'll take it apart here. First, if there's anybody who tends to be pretty critical of a lot of scientific stuff, it is I. I'm very, very skeptical of a lot of scientific claims, but not of all. And properly done, well done, science really is a very helpful tool. It's not infallible, but it's a very helpful tool. And particularly the science related to genetic modification... Well, that blows my whole answer, doesn't it? No. The scientific work being done related to genetic modification, agricultural production increase, and things of that nature tends to be far less politicized. Doesn't mean absolutely not, but far less politicized than that related to climate change and sexuality. And I have read a fair amount in the genetic modification debates, not probably as much as Dr. Kosterman here. He's really done a lot of work in that field. But what I have seen has persuaded me that genetic modification, in principle anyway, is an acceptable method of exercising dominion over the earth. I would have to ask the someone who would pose this sort of thing to me, give me examples. Show me an example of what you consider to be faulty science supporting genetic modification. The question goes on. There are many valid concerns about GMO and the, quote, goodness, unquote, of our modern society. Well, again, I'd want to know what you consider those valid concerns to be. I think there are especially questions when we get to issues about genetic modification of human beings. And yet, we actually, if we look at genetically rooted diseases, like Tay-Sachs disease, for instance, I would be very grateful to the Lord if someone came up with a way of doing some gene splicing that would eliminate Tay-Sachs disease from the human race. I think that would be a wonderful thing. I cannot figure any reason why that would be a bad thing. Now, if we're going to talk about giving humans wings, I might have problems there. Well, I might. Now, to go on, many of the reports of poor living conditions in the past come from Europe and perhaps Africa. There is substantial history regarding Asia to suggest that they were quite free from American diseases like cancer and heart issues. About 15 years ago, yeah, right about that, I was, about 18 years ago, I was the managing editor for a big fat book called The State of Humanity. It's 58 chapters by 60 different authors, including 8 Nobel Prize winners, looking at all sorts of different aspects of human health and longevity, human standard of living, the quality of the environment, availability of resources, on and on and on. It's an amazing book. The general editor of that book was the late Julian Simon, who was one of the great great scholars in this whole field. And we included chapters in there, several different chapters, on human health and longevity, particularly life expectancy, through the ages, insofar as data were available that were reasonably credible. And there was no significant difference between human health and longevity in Asia versus Europe versus Africa versus even were able to get some data on North and South America pre-Columbus because archaeological studies can actually figure out from human remains in graves what sorts of diseases people had, how old they were when they died, and so on. Until the Industrial Revolution, life expectancy at birth was at the same everywhere in the world, about 27 to 28 years. The various diseases were sprinkled around until Europeans came to the New World. There was not smallpox in the New World, but then there were also diseases taken back the opposite direction from the New World to the Old World. There's no indication, syphilis for example, right, there had been no syphilis in the Old World until the discovery of the New World, and that was taken back the other direction. The notion that that cancer rates were lower in Asia prior to the introduction of a more Americanized diet is also, I think, quite mistaken. Cancer is basically an age-indexed disease, which means that a rising overall rate for cancer in the population as a whole is good news. Huh? Yes, because it means people are living longer. There's no indication that any of the varieties of cancer that we know of has become more common if you index for age, with one exception: skin cancer. Any guess as to why? No guesses? Pardon? Well, actually, those are used by so few people that they don't really affect overall rates in any measurable way. But you're close. There are really two things that figure in. The first is that people have a whole lot more leisure time now than they used to in the developed world, in wealthy countries. And they spend a lot of that leisure time outdoors, and they spend a great deal of that time outdoors with little clothing on. So in other words, they subject themselves to ultraviolet rays at a much higher rate than they used to. But there really is not good evidence, as far as the studies that I've seen, and I've seen quite a few, that somehow or other the Asian diet made Asians less susceptible to cancer and so on than we have been. I guess One other here asked in relation to that, what's my view on organic farming versus GMO conventional farming and GM animals? I've addressed GM already. Let me address organic. There is no legal definition of organic food in America. There isn't in most of the other developed countries in the world. Anybody can put the organic label on anything he grows. There are voluntary associations that say what they require for you to have their label of organic on your food, but an awful lot of food that goes by that name in the stores, in fact, is not different in any significant way from that raised in typical industrial farming. Now, furthermore, the yield per acre, the yield per input of capital, and especially the yield per hour of human labor from so-called organically grown foods is much, much smaller than the yield from foods grown using artificial fertilizers and artificial pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides. The yield is so much smaller that if we were to try to raise the same amount of food to feed the human race that we do now, using all the so-called organic methods, we would have to be farming something in the neighborhood of 6 times as much land as we do. The price of food would be multiples higher than it is now. That would be bad for the poor. It would be bad for natural habitats. We already take an enormous amount of land to feed the human race, a much smaller amount than we would have without the high-tech agriculture. But for anybody who cares about not really heavily stressing natural habitats, ecosystems, and particularly the possibility of pushing some species toward extinction, the notion that we should stay away from high-tech farming, I think, is quite paradoxical, really very inconsistent. So I would say we really do need to be very, very careful with critically reading a lot of the claims that appear in front of us. I've done my best. I am mostly very favorable to high-tech farming, very favorable to GMO, and not very favorable to organic. In fact, I'll add two other things about organic. One, organic foods tend to have less value in terms of vitamins and minerals than standard grown foods. And two, organic foods tend to be higher in carcinogens and other natural poisons, natural toxins, than artificially grown or industrial grown foods. The reason for that is that all plants have their own natural, we could call them antibodies if they were animals instead of plants. They work essentially the same way. When a plant is attacked by some organism, it generates defense mechanisms. Some of those defense mechanisms are toxic, some of them are carcinogenic. The fewer attacks the plant experiences, the fewer of those antibodies, so to speak, it produces. Well, by our using very narrowly targeted chemical pesticides, we can reduce the attacks on the plants, and so they don't produce as much. For those of you who might want to follow up on that, absolutely the world's top expert in that field was Dr. Bruce Ames of the University of California at Berkeley. Most scientists are happy if they can get 12 to, say, a dozen and a half refereed journal articles published in a lifetime. The last I counted, or the last count that I saw, was in the mid-90s. He had over 400. And he specialized in researching the carcinogens associated with various different vegetables and fruits and so on. and his findings were very consistent, and they have been verified by many other studies as well. We need to stop being afraid of man-made things and recognize that nature is not best untouched by human hands. We are called by God to be involved in reversing the curse and its effects. And part of that we can do even through high-tech farming.
No, I don't, but maybe I wish I did. Might be better income.
Yeah, well, I have a question here about something I said, I think it was last night. Here's the question. You had said in one of your lectures that election is an ongoing work not completed at one time. But unless I'm mistaken, I thought that election was a final decisive act of God when he elected us, believers, for eternal life. Could you clarify what you meant, that election was an ongoing work? And the person adds, thank you. Very nice. What I said involved this phrase last night from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. You recall that Peter says that we are elect exiles. Last night I was using the New American Standard Version that said we are aliens of the dispersion, chosen according to the foreknowledge of God, in the sanctification of the Spirit. And it's at that point that I talked about the process of our election not yet being concluded, by which I meant to say, and I did say at that point that I did not intend to contradict the eternality establishment of the decree of election, but by which I meant to say that our election continues to be worked out, not only from our side of things in terms of working out our calling and election to be sure that we're in the Lord, but there's a working out that occurs from God's side too in the sanctifying work of the Holy Spirit. So I don't mean to play one off against the other. I don't mean to undermine the one by the other. I simply mean to suggest that it is an incomplete understanding of election to view it as, shall we say, a done deal. It's a done deal with continuing process-oriented development in the life of a believer. That, I hope, clarifies what I said. Not a contradiction, but an amplification of election. So, that's one of four questions, and I'll turn the mic over to our latest guest.
Last. Well, in this case, I won't be first, but... Anyway, the question, first one I'll go over with you is this. Is it hypocritical, wrong, dangerous to try and point others toward Christ when you yourself have doubts about your faith? I think if we let ourselves be stopped by our doubts, then we'd be dominated by doubt. That's a...
Hold it a little closer.
A little closer?
Yeah.
I think we'll be stopped all the time. I think there's nothing ever that's hypocritical, wrong, or dangerous to do and to say the right thing. It is always the right thing to share the truth of Christ. You're not sharing yourself necessarily, and even if you share your own doubts at that point, say, look, I'm someone who's struggling with my own faith, but I know He is Lord. I know He is the truth. I know He's the way, the truth, and the life. I'm calling you to Him, not to me. So even if you say, hey, but, you know, Rich, you've got these doubts. How can you call me to believe something that you seem to be questioning yourself? Whatever I'm questioning is not the issue. Faith goes beyond our questions and our doubts. All of us at some time or another will have a doubt. What would be hypocritical would be to speak to a person who's not a believer, call them to faith in Jesus Christ, if they say, what about you? Have you ever doubted? And say, never. Not me. Don't even talk to me like that. What's wrong with you? Do you see something that I don't see? No. But you see, it is never wrong to say and do the right thing. Hypocritical is something like this. Let me give you an example you might see more familiarity with. if you have a job and you have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get there working, 5 o'clock comes and you roll out of bed and it's like, oh, I can't believe I have to do this again. And you wait 27 years until I retire. You know, and you're miserable. And then when you get to work and someone says, what's it like for you? And you say, well, 5 o'clock came around, I just decided 5 o'clock, I'd rather get up at 4 o'clock. It's just a little too late for me at 5 o'clock. You see, that's hypocritical. It's sort of deceiving, putting a mask on, being two-faced. And you don't have to be two-faced if you have a doubt. You can be honest with people. You should be transparent. And that transparency not only will help someone we're speaking to, it will help us to see that God can use us effectively in spite of our weakness, in spite of our own limitations, even in spite of our doubts. Doubt isn't the worst thing in the world. We doubt all kinds of things. I doubt immensely what Calvin just said about organic food. Literally. We went for a bite to eat last night. And here's something, this, listening to him, this is what bothered me. We're sitting there, and he said, I'd like an omelet. And then she said, okay, I'll get how many eggs? He said, a couple of eggs. And then she said, okay. And he said, wait a minute. They are organic, aren't they? Oh, you didn't. Oh, sorry. Okay.
I have a growth question here. How much time do? How many days do we have to answer this question? Now I want to read the whole question. It says, "I understand the prophet commands the good servants. Good servants is in quotes, and helps them do it more. How does that relate to products which are morally objectionable? For instance, the pornography industry makes millions of dollars profit, yet I would not call them good servants. Can you perhaps tie this into what you said about the personal motivation of each person and their moral beliefs and practices?" I got, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde here, I got two sides of me now. One side wants me to challenge some of the claims here in this statement. And for example, the pornography industry makes millions of dollars profit. I don't know if that's true.
It does
billions? Okay. All right. So it probably does.
Probably over 12 billion.
Okay. Maybe, I don't know. What's, and the other side of me is the theologian, and here's what I'm going to, I want to go into. That's a very important question. When we're talking about the economy and economics from a biblical perspective, how do we deal with that part of it that is seems to follow biblical economic principles but for morally objectionable goals? Let me tell you this, it's not just in the economy, it's in every area of life we see the same paradox, the same problem that we need to resolve. For example, we all know that a good family is a Christian virtue, right? You all come from good Christian families. You wouldn't be here if you don't. But you have good families, and you have your fathers and your mothers, and they take you to church. And that's the reason you're here listening to us, old man. I'm the youngest one, okay? Telling you about...
Are the ugliest one?
We can tell a New Yorker.
You're New York.
I thought shrinks cared about other people's feelings.
That's true. It's a lie.
It's in the families too. A family is a godly institution, we know, but let me tell you this. China for many centuries used to have very, very strong families for morally objectionable goals. Did you hear that? China used to have a very strong family culture for centuries. That's the way their whole civilization was preserved, but it was for morally objectionable goals. They built a static pagan society. And that pagan society for many centuries were very hostile to Christianity. It killed so many Christians, and the families were used to oppose the Christian faith. We can see it in every other area of life. I mean, we see so many great scientists that are evolutionists, and they oppose Christianity. And one of my favorite examples is Isaac Asimov. I mean, here's a guy who is so smart that he's so smart, and he's such a great mind if you go to the Dewey Library Index, there is not a single department there that doesn't have a book written by Isaac Asimov. He's probably the only person that has a book written in every one of them. But yet he was a staunch opponent of Christianity. So you have this, you have his intellectual discipline, which is a godly, which is a biblical virtue, and he is using it against Christianity. What's the answer in this whole thing? The answer is this: we always look at all the disciplines, all the academic and all the disciplines of all the academic disciplines, the disciplines of knowledge, as relative. And I'm not talking about putting relativism, moral relativism in them, but relative to something else. We look at all these disciplines as servants to one discipline. And what is that discipline? What is the queen of all academic disciplines according to universities of all?
What is it?
It's theology. Okay. So before we go to economics, let me start with this. Before we go to economics, we need to start with theology. That's why this whole thing started with Dr. Klosterman preaching to us. It didn't start with me, with speaking about economics, because economics is a servant discipline to theology. So before we go into economics, we need to understand that we can only talk about economics as long as we have subjected our thinking, our assessment of the world to the moral demands of the gospel. And when we have subjected all of this, then we can talk about economics. And then, when we see something in economics that is not subjected to the moral demands of the gospel, to the moral demands of theology as our discipline, then we know that's outside of our area of economic area, then we need to look at it through theological eyes. And yet, even there, they're trying to mimic the biblical principles of economics, and that's how they make all this money. It's outside of our the moral scope of what a Christian should consider good stewardship. So we always need to understand economics is relative. Not relative in terms of it's got relative standards in it, but economics is relative to the absolute discipline that controls them all. And this is theology. Why? Because God has to be the overall concern in everything we say and everything we do. God and His law is our standard for everything. And when we go to economy, we know that we have areas of economy that we need to condemn completely because they're morally objectionable. Just like when we go to the family, we know that there are cultures that are strong family cultures, but we still need to condemn them because family is not absolute. God is absolute and the gospel is absolute, but not the family, not the economy, not being a good servant, not profit, not loss. It's all relative to God. And I think this is the answer to this question. It is possible sometimes for us to fall into the mistake of saying, hey, he's just a good servant. I mean, I had a friend once who worked in a bingo. I don't think a Christian should work for a gambling. Now, I mean, you can play poker at home, you know, just play, but I don't think a Christian should work in the gambling industry. And he thought, well, I'm just a good servant. I read all the good books, Christian good books on Christian economics, I'm just a good servant. Well, the problem is, he read the good books on biblical economics, but he didn't read the good books on the gospel. So he decided that economics is the gospel by itself. So always keep this in mind. What I say about economics always needs to be subject to what Dr. Klosterman says about God's demands. Because she's older than me. I think that answers the question, right? No, not the last one, but the whole thing that I said.
Okay. My next one is, what hard evidence or logic should I use to convince a gullible soul that she has been misled about global warming? If she's that gullible, you don't really need that much hard evidence or logic, right? Well, I might approach it this way. Which way has she been, according to you, misled? If she's been misled to believe that human action doesn't have much to do with it and that it's not a big problem and we really don't need to do anything about it, well then keep your hands off, okay? If she's misled to think that it's a big problem and we're causing it and we need to, you know, go back into the dark ages to solve the problem, then by all means do something about it. Now, to get a little bit serious here. First of all, my lecture tomorrow morning will be on this very topic. I can quit now. I would take her first to a document that we have on the website of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation called A Renewed Call to Truth, Prudence, and Protection of the Poor, an Evangelical Examination of the Theology, Science, and Economics of Global Warming. Go to cornwallalliance.org. You'll see a list over to the left of key documents. Go to the Renewed Call to Truth. It's a 76-page document with three chapters, one on theology, one on science, one on economics, that addresses the issue very, very well. It was done by 29 PhD scholars, roughly evenly divided among the three topics. And I think that you'll find that very solid. Also, we have in the Resisting the Green Dragon DVD lecture series a lecture on global warming by Dr. David LeGates, who is professor of climatology at the University of Delaware and was for many years the Delaware State climatologist. That music, by the way, that you were just hearing is from our website, from the homepage. And it is from a CD of meditative piano treatments of hymns by my daughter Susan. And so if you go to Parnassum.net, you can get her lovely music to help you to meditate on the hymns that you love so much. Commercial over. Next, a few other recommendations here. My favorite of all the books that critique global warming alarmism is a book by Ross McKittrick and Christopher Essex called Taken by Storm, and then there's a subtitle to it as well. McKittrick is an economist specializing in environmental economics who has been an expert reviewer for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Essex is an applied mathematician and physicist and has also been an expert reviewer for the IPCC. This book cuts to the very heart of the issue by challenging the whole notion from the realm of physics of average temperature. And I won't try to explain to you why there is no such thing. It will strike you as very strange, but the beginnings of the problems in the science of global warming alarmism are at a very, very fundamental level of misunderstanding of basic physics. But the book treats much more than that. It's really an outstanding read, and much of it's quite funny. Once they've determined that there is no such thing as average temperature, for example, they say, well, then what are these numbers that we're hearing about, you know, global average temperature? Well, we have to take part in the conversation about this stuff, but we don't want to mislead you by calling it global average temperature. This whole issue seems to have just gobbled up the world, so we'll call this T-Rex. It's this temperature statistic. It doesn't really mean anything, but everybody talks about it, so we'll talk about it too, but we'll call it T-Rex to remind you that it doesn't mean anything. That's a very good book. Also, a book by Donna Laframboise, L-A-F-R-A-N-B-O-I-S-E, Donna Laframboise, called The Delinquent Teenager Who Was Mistaken for the World's Top Climate Scientist. The delinquent teenager is the UN IPCC. Laframboise is a retired journalist in Canada who set out to do basically an audit of the IPCC. Was it living up to its own rules, particularly regarding a rule that any source that it cited had to be a refereed source from a refereed scientific journal. What she found, and she involved hundreds of people from around the world in checking all of the thousands and thousands and thousands of sources cited, was that no chapter cited fewer than 30% non-refereed sources. Many chapters cited over 50% non-refereed sources. And many of these sources came from international environmental advocacy organizations. And then she discusses all sorts of corruption in the whole IPCC process. A lot of people are simply intimidated by the notion that the IPCC is the gold standard of climate science. It is not. It is an extremely politicized body. It's filled with corruption. It doesn't obey its own rules. Last year, it adopted a conflict of interest policy for its authors, and then promptly announced in June of last year that the authors of the next assessment report, which is due to come out in 2013, will not be subject to the conflict of interest policy, because after all, they had already been chosen. The corruption is rife. Last reading recommendation is by Roy Spencer, The Great Global Warming Blunder. Spencer is a climatologist, an outstanding scientist at the University of Alabama. He is the lead scientist on NASA's satellite remote sensing program that is the only thing that provides us with 24/7, 365, all altitudes, all latitudes, all longitudes, readings of atmospheric temperature all around the world. He is the lead scientist on that. He's been working in this field for over 35 years. And he wrote an outstanding book, very accessible to laymen. And finally, people are often intimidated, too, by the claim that, after all, there's this overwhelming consensus. The claim is false. It never has been true. It would be irrelevant even if it were true, because science is not a matter of consensus. Consensus is how you get people into office. That's politics. Science is a matter of evidence and cogency of explanation. However, for people who are impressed by numbers, you can send them to petitionproject.org, which lists over 31,000 scientists. It gives their degrees, it gives their areas of specialization, who have signed the petition saying, in essence, that there is no credible scientific evidence that human activity is contributing in any significant way to a warming of the Earth, or that there will be any danger from any such warming, but there is overwhelming scientific evidence that increased CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is beneficial to all life, because for every doubling of CO2, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in hotter and colder climates, in drier and wetter soil. They resist diseases and pests better. They yield more fruit. That is, since everything else eats plants, If plants do well, everything else does better, and so more CO2 is actually a good thing, not a bad thing.
Wow. That was good.
Yeah, that's good. Well, this is the second question asking me to explain something I've said. I have to confess I have two problems, at least, when I speak or preach. One is I'm given to exaggeration to make people think. And the second thing is that I don't repeat myself. So that if people stop and are shocked at what they hear and don't hear the subsequent explanation or contextualization of my statement, it sort of stands out like a pebble under one's tongue, to use an analogy someone has brought up. You mentioned in a lecture this morning that, quote, God sends nobody to hell, people send themselves, end quote. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding this, but, there's the but, wouldn't this statement imply that God is not sovereign?
Do you need some pebbles?
Yes, I do. God sends nobody to hell, people send themselves, is what I said, among other things. How does this relate, then, to divine sovereignty, God's sovereignty? Well, first of all, if I may demand, I don't have a drawing board here, so you have to imagine with me two concentric circles, one larger than the other. The larger one we'll call divine sovereignty. The one inside it, smaller, we'll call human responsibility. That's a very reformed and, I think, biblical attempt to explain the relationship between sovereignty and responsibility. Other people, other Christians, put these circles side by side in opposition to each other, as though human responsibility is independent, autonomous, and outside of divine sovereignty. I don't believe that. So when I say God sends nobody to hell, people send themselves, the purpose of that statement is to remind us that people are culpable, responsible for their own decisions and their own rejection and their own rebellion against God. You recall, perhaps, that I also said, when we get to heaven, we will say in joy and in truthfulness, thank God. He alone was responsible for that. Should we, God forbid, should anybody go to hell, they will have only themselves to blame. Only themselves. They'll never be able to say, God, you decreed this. God, you decreed that I go to hell. What choice did I have? How could I not have come to hell? That's a misunderstanding and a misuse of divine sovereignty, turning it even against God himself, who commands all men everywhere to repent and believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. So you see, the exaggeration exists in this claim, God sends nobody to hell. We understand that divine sovereignty is the wider circle. But the real point that I wished to have made by way of warning and exhortation is that people send themselves to hell and will never ever be able to blame God, who is sovereign, for that. So I hope that explains it better.
And this will be the last one for the evening. Hang on to the ones you didn't answer for tomorrow night.
Oh, why did you have to get that question? I don't want to get into that question, but I don't have the same kind of difficulty that whoever wrote the question to you. I think it demands so much care in putting the language. And I don't mean to be. Well, I don't want to say it. I don't want to make. I think we have to be very, very careful with that because God is sovereign and. I don't consider myself a double predestinarian. And you know what that means. So, he doesn't have as good a sense of humor as I do. No, but I'm not being funny now. But, I would say that demands its own discussion for a considerable period of time. And I would say it merits that. It's a great question and it provokes good consideration. I'd like to just deal with the question, another very, very important question that I was asked. Dr. Vance, has anyone ever asked you to fill in for Steve Jobs at an Apple keynote convention? Steve Jobs is dead. Didn't you know that? If I go to an Apple convention, it won't be a fill-in for him. I hope not.
But I do want to, I want to take one question. I'd like to speak to the person who wrote that question. I'm just interested. So how many of you wrote that question together? No, here's the question I do want to deal with. Yeah.
How does one keep his or her mind from impure thoughts? What discipline do I use? Are you speaking myself or you? And I'll answer that question as best I can. And I deal with that question continually in counseling because this is one of the critical problems, not just someone coming for counseling, everyone deals with impure thoughts on all kinds of levels that involve impurity of thinking. Does that answer your question? I hope no one thought that I didn't answer anything yet. I'm just saying that is a problem, and it's a real problem. You know, the Bible says in Philippians 4, 8, and 9, whatever is good, whatever is true, whatever is lovely, whatever is beautiful, if there's anything excellent, anything worthy of good repute, let your mind, your thoughts, either one is a correct translation, let your mind, your thoughts dwell on these things, the things you've learned and received and heard and seen in me. These things do, and the God of peace will be with you. It's evident from this that there is a real dimension of restlessness and lack of peace when people are not thinking upon those things that are good and beautiful and right and true and lovely. That is what happens. Then it's very easy to let your mind focus not only on what's not good or true or right, but to go right down further and further into what is impure and ugly and awful and demeaning. First of all, when you catch yourself thinking about things which are not good or true or right or lovely, stop yourself. Stop yourself immediately. Ask forgiveness. Lord, forgive me. It's sinful to be thinking about what is ugly, awful, false, and it's even more ugly and more false if you're using impure. I'm sure you're using it in the context of sexual impurity. I mean, I imagine you're doing that, and I mean, you're asking that kind of question, perhaps thinking in that kind of way. And the more you think in that way, especially when you're young guys, especially, the more difficult you're going to make it for yourself when you find the woman that you love, because she is not going to match up to the impurity, especially if it's related to images and movies and magazines and the slick pictures of these individuals that never match up with the reality that a human being, a man, takes as his wife.
The GMO woman.
That's the genetically modified woman. I mean, it's a horror. We're making a joke about it, GMOs. But look, guys, seriously, cause yourself to have a trigger. You stop yourself. You cause yourself. Look, that passage starts with, I think it's be anxious for nothing, but everything with prayer along with thanksgiving. Let your request be made known to God, and the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will guard your hearts and your mind in Christ Jesus. And then it goes into. So it's dealing with anxiety, it's dealing with focusing, prayer, petition, and then thanksgiving. God, thank you for all things. Help me with this. And then get up from where you are. Don't sit there, let's say, with a magazine that's corrupting your mind. Don't sit there with a thought and like, oh, I can't do anything. Get up, get out of here, go for a run, go for a walk, write a letter to a friend, do some studies in your work. Or I mean, really, get off of what you're dealing with. Don't sit there and say, oh, I can't help it, or it'll be over soon. And usually if it's over soon for the wrong reasons, guys, and that's not going to help you at all. Believe me, it's not going to. You've got to train yourself to learn how to think about what is good and right and true, and force yourself to break from the patterns that think about what's ugly and awful, because you will make yourself unproductive, unloving, unkind. You will wind up having complaints about your wife if the Lord provides one, and I hope he wouldn't in that case, because you'll destroy her if your mind has been filled with impurity.
because that will wreck a relationship. I find myself utterly astounded as a pastor at the number of men who I am thinking of as wonderful, godly men, and they're coming to me. They're enmeshed in the sin of observing pornography. And it is wretched. It's a vile sin. Honestly, it's a disgusting, perverted sin. I've done some conferences on this, and I'm going to tell you one of my conclusions. It is as addictive as cocaine. It may be more addictive because you can get it easier. You can satisfy yourself quicker. There are no physical seeming discomforts that come with it, but there's guilt, there's shame, and there's the destruction of your mind. This is what we're talking about. I'm going to deal with more in terms of youth and the kinds of patterns you can develop to guard and protect your mind. But I'm telling you, this is the worst. You need to have someone you can be accountable with. This is another thing. Have someone, your pastor or one of the elders or one of the godly young men in the church that you know is not involved in this sin. And meet with this person. It doesn't have to be regular so that you become a pain in the neck to this guy. But at least if you're having trouble, you got someone you can call up. I'm saying it's that serious. You don't want to let it keep going. If you've got a real problem with it, get to someone so you can break it now. If you're 16 and you're not breaking it, you're not going to break it more easily when you're 18. You're not going to become more mature. You're going to become more sophisticated in learning how to lie about this. Cover it up, make it secret, put a wall between yourself and others. Find some girl and you think, this will help and cure it. No, it won't. Because it's in your mind. And if your mind and your heart are given over to these things, you've got to break it. And you've got to break it. The sooner you break it, I'm telling you, if some of you guys want to meet afterwards with me about this, I'll sit and talk with you. I'll talk with you as long as you need to talk. I'll wait afterwards. And you know, don't worry if someone sees you coming to meet in a group with me about this, like, oh, he's one of those perverts. No, don't worry if that. It's better that we can meet outside, honestly. So you know what? I mean it. But if you want to deal with it, you want to deal with it a little more tonight, then meet outside. I'll meet you there, the parking lot, and we'll talk. I don't know what you're giggling about. I'm totally serious about this.
Thank you all very much.